if we can, can we kind of start out with where was there, you know, usually there's a defining moment in everybody's life where they decide what kind of direction they want to follow. Was there an album that you heard or a performance that you saw or something that made you want to be a musician?
Good question. Well, when I was like about, I think I was my 13th birthday, I went to see Emerson, Lake and Palmer in on the brain solid surgery tour, and it was in Quad. And I think that was like not like a moment that made me say I wanted to make music, but it definitely like was like a moment where I found myself. And I don't know how a 13-year-old destined course, I think, towards electronics and stuff. After I saw Keith Emerson's synthesizer setup, I was very intrigued by it, and I used to find myself going down to the stores to look at synthesizers, which at the time were just completely archaic still, like they were, you know, demodular stuff mostly.
Right.
And that was probably it, so I'd have to say that Emerson, Lake and Palmer show.
And then when did you get, did you start off playing drums or did you start off with keyboards or synthesizers?
Both, actually. My dad had a piano and an organ, one of the ones with the, you know, like you hold down a key and it could have like rhythms.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So luckily I had both of those to, like a piano and an organ to basically start out on. And then one day, one of my friends was like just this really awesome drummer named Mike Carter. And he was just like, we would go to the store and I would end up looking at the synthesizers and he would end up looking at the drums. And when he was looking at the drums, he would sit down and play some shit and everybody in the whole store would gather around him. So it was like pretty inspirational. And he said, well, you should try drumming too. It's fun. And so he basically taught me how to drum. My dad sort of helped by getting me a snare drum. And from there, so I sort of, you know, got into it. And I think like 3 weeks later, I was in a band.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty quick
Kiss covers.
Yeah.
On drums, too.
Nice. Was it a full drum set then, or was it just the snare drum?
Yeah, I rented a drum kit, and it was like a little Tiger swirl type of, I don't remember what type it was, but it was like, you know, one of those old school styles.
Yeah. So, by having sort of your first kind of awakening be Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, do you think that that really kind of set that course for you as far as like wanting to be more experimental or more progressive, for lack of a better?
Really find myself still going down that road. I was exploring like the typical things that kids explore at the time, which was like Kiss, Rush, and
right,
you know, the sort of typical things that happened. I went to see David Bowie in like about 1970. And he played Kraftwerk Radioactivity as his opening act, with the lights down, and he showed Salvador Dali's In Shendaloo at the same time. And so it was like a complete mind melt for someone who had never seen anything like that or heard anything like that. And that changed my life. Like literally I felt my life just go boink and just change right
yeah.
at that moment. The next day I threw away all my records and I went out and I looked for that album Radioactivity, and that sort of really changed that forever. And then about 2 or 3 years later, I guess it would be 2 years later, my father sent me to Japan on a youth exchange trip. And, you know, odd, and there was a lot of people wearing like weird plastic clothing and stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing had really happened there yet, but I stayed there and I went back. Like I came back and then I went back a year later. And by that time, New Wave had sort of started. Like it was 1980.
Yeah.
And the whole sort of punk scene. I came back from Japan and the punk scene was alive. Like DOA and the Sex Pistols had just started. And so that, a lot of my friends were really into punk. And we used to form a punk band. We were two or three punk bands. And then I went back to Japan, and then when I went back there, I ran into Kraftwerk again. I said, people were like playing showroom dummies and all sorts of stuff on the robots. And then I also was like seeing people over in Japan that were like sort of dressed like quite odd, like almost like it was glam, but it wasn't really glam yet. So it was like this. Just at the time, it just seemed like a wave music, you might want to call it at that point. Like
right.
Japan, the band Japan, Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Yeah.
And so on.
Cool. How did that, like, how did that kind of frame, or that sort of time frame lead you? I know, like, your first sort of bigger band was Images in Vogue, which was a lot more of a sort of a straightforward pop band.
Yeah, right after I came back from Japan, I actually went to a record store. It was so funny. And I met this guy at the record store, and I just said, oh, I just got back from Japan. I'm looking for this record. And he was actually, I was looking for Quiet Life by Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a huge Japan fan. And he said, oh, you like these guys? And I said, yeah, well, they're pretty huge in Japan and stuff. And I had showed him some other records that I got. And he said, we should get together because I play in a band, and we sort of play sounds like that. And so I ran into him again, and he said, you should join the band.
Mm-hmm.
I was like sort of talked into going down and auditioning and stuff. And went down, met these guys, and they were so into it, like completely 100% dedicated to what they were doing. And they were into, you know, Ultravox and Japan and like the whole sort of wave scene at the time. And that's how we started out. And the guys that were in the band were pretty incredibly talented people.
Mm-hmm.
Each guy was really into their own setup, and they were mostly synthesizers. And so I got certain kind. The guy Glenn, who was in the band, was into like more of the Oberheim style, and so on and so on. So I could really, you know, learn quite a bit. And then quickly, very quickly, like within a year, we became almost popular in Canada. Started touring, and before we knew it, we were opening for, I think, like the first one was Roxy Music, and then did a few shows with them on the Avalon tour. And then we opened for Depeche Mode the first time they ever came to America.
Mm-hmm.
When they still had just the tape deck and the four mics.
Yeah.
And then we toured with Duran Duran a couple of times and found ourselves in front of, like, you know, 15,000 people playing our music.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden I realized that I wasn't really into the music. It was I was really into, like, playing and really into it, but I wasn't really wholeheartedly into what I was playing.
Uh-huh.
So I went down to L.A. in 1984 and made an album. I realized that maybe, because I'd already made Mother Tope and, you know, a few of the other songs, like, on my own, with sort of experiments that we were doing in the studio with Dave Ogilvy and stuff, it just sort of quickly became apparent that, you know, when I would get around equipment, I would make something that sounded different, even though I couldn't quite figure out what it was.
Right.
So then we were partying quite a bit. We were listening to some, like, you know, more experimental stuff, like Pyrolator and stuff. And it was really, like, apparent to me that, you know, this was where my interest was lying, was with much more heavy-duty stuff.
Right.
But then again, the heavy-duty stuff at that time didn't really have stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we got together one day, and I just, this was like, had my typical sort of drum machine and Pro One or whatever, and just started recording, and Ogre happened to be there, and it was weird, it was sort of at a party, and I was just, at that time, not really doing any drinking or any drugs of any kind, and I was just sitting around on the equipment while everyone else was partying, and came up with something which was Canine, which is on the Back and Forth cassette.
Uh-huh.
Ogre heard it, and I said, oh, he was showing a bit of interest, and he seemed like he was sort of down with it, so I said, why don't you write some lyrics, and you can basically sing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go to an Images of Vogue rehearsal that day, came back, and he had written lyrics, and I recorded them, and the first song was sort of invented.
Wow.
King Puppy, Canine, Life as Seen Through a Dog's Eyes, the concept.
Uh-huh.
And it's fat. And I manufactured some 35 copies or something of the cassette and passed them out to people, and then it went on sale in this little shop, and they sold out the first day.
Uh-huh.
And we realized that there was an interest, but we didn't really know how much. So the guy who was running the record store at the time, who was just selling records behind the counter, is this guy named Terry McBride, who is, like, now the president of Network,
mm-hmm.
and a multimillionaire, too, I might add. And we were just hanging with him, and he said, you know, if you want to release an album, I'd be into, like, releasing it. So everything all just came together. We knew Stephen Gilmore. Actually, Stephen Gilmore, the artist who makes all the record covers, mm-hmm. was a DJ at the time, and he had a flair for his artwork going at the time already. I don't know what. I think he was doing posters for the club where he was DJing.
Yeah.
But it really did propel us into wanting to make the record.
Mm-hmm.
So Ogre and I were both at that time, ironically, going through the same thing. Both of our parents had cancer, and they were in remission.
Uh-huh.
And so we put all of our energy into it. I think I spent $600 making that record. The first record.
Wow.
Huge budget.
Yeah.
And we labeled it Remission as to the common sides, and the rest is just, you might want to say, history for everything, because following that, Network sort of catapulted itself into something legitimate, and then we started getting a lot of attention, more attention than Images in Vogue, and whenever I would show up with Images in Vogue to do a show, people would ask me to sign this for Skinny Puppy record.
Yeah.
So pretty soon after that, I got talked into it by my friends to quit Images in Vogue and concentrate fully on Skinny Puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like your early 80s, and now it's like 20-something years later.
Yeah.
And now you're talking to me.
How has the writing process changed on everything? You know, I've read a lot about how, you know, it's sort of kind of divided, where you do music and then it goes to Ogre and then it comes back, where it sounds like the early stuff, it sounds like you guys were both kind of in the same place and working on things at the same time. How has that evolved, and what is that process like?
Well, it always starts with music, and then we typically, well, there isn't really a typical, and then we would go through them and pick
mm-hmm.
which ones would be suitable to work on.
Right.
And then we would work with Ogre on those, much like how I did that first song,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then once we have vocals on it, you sort of get a clearer picture about what the idea really is. I mean, you can, you know, strangely, Ogre would sing in ways that we could never predict. We would think we knew what we were going to hear, but we would never end up hearing what we did. So that was a bit of the magic, I think.
Uh-huh.
And then Dave Ogilvie at the beginning, trying new things and trying this and that. But I really think the digital delay, like when we first discovered the Lexicon PCM41 digital delay, that really like opened the door for what Skinny Puppy was, because it was really about a particular sound that we were hearing that we thought we were, I don't know, most interested in. And I really think that, like, I'll never forget the first day I touched a digital delay.
Yeah.
I figured, this is, okay, here I go. This is, I don't know what this thing is doing, but I sure love it.
Yeah.
And if you listen to a bunch of our earliest stuff, you can see that we were just going overboard bananas with them. And
mm-hmm.
now I actually look back at that and I go, I actually really like how overboard and bananas the delay work is.
Yeah.
So a lot of it, we didn't really know what we were doing at the time, but we knew what we wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go into the studio late at night and spend all night long just trying to conjure up this, like, vibe.
Yeah.
And then typically we would have to finish a song in one night, so that's how we did it most of the time,
mm-hmm.
all the way up until, like, say, let's say Two Dark Park or something.
Yeah.
When we started having a bit more time
mm-hmm.
to do things, and then we started writing in the studio instead of writing beforehand.
Yeah.
With more acoustic instruments and such.
Okay. Today,
when we got back together, you know, after not being together for eight years or however long it was,
mm-hmm.
we still work much the same. Only all of us have our own sort of studios now.
Yeah.
And we work with vocals on a instrumental song that opens a new picture, a new idea, and then we then go back and re-elaborate on that.
Mm-hmm. Does it usually happen where you have, like, these musical ideas and you send them, and, like, the lyrical ideas will change the structure of it? Because,
yep.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem like a lot of what you do is, like, you know, verse, chorus, verse, you know, kind of arrangements at all. So it seems like there would have to be a lot of sort of give and take that way.
Well, in the first phase of the band, up until Last Rites or wherever the process, not changed too much.
Oh, okay.
We would try and work around what the original composition was.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that is fun about working with Mark Walker as a producer is that he actually takes the idea and breaks it down into, I guess, sections, and then works vocals around those sections and then rearranges it based on how those sections flow.
Oh, okay.
So it is a completely different style of how we work, but in some ways I actually sort of think it works well for us in that way because it's even less predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, the oddities of like some of the stuff that would be written instrumentally don't end up being as odd.
Yeah.
A little bit more cohesive, I think.
So you basically have to kind of relearn the song once it's put together by Mark Walk, huh?
Well, it's like your eyes get open to a new perspective of what the potential of that song is. I mean, you remember it of what you, and then that opens your mind up to working with yourself, mm-hmm. like yourself as a different person.
Yeah.
And then you can reapproach the same idea, but be more objective about how something works or doesn't work. And it's quite a cool idea, actually.
Yeah. It probably frees you up a lot, too, to feel like you can experiment more because you know that there's somebody there that can sort of rein it in when it needs to be reined in. Or
well, and yeah. I mean, it's not so easy as what I sometimes can imagine, because sometimes you may get attached to a certain idea about how it works and it comes back and it isn't anything the same. And then you try and think, like, well, what is it that I can then see out of this that I don't see in the other one? And then you realize that you become attached to your original idea. You have to let go of that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start like thinking about the bigger picture. And I think there's a lot of that with life in general. You know, what people throw back at you and how you work is typically about life. You know, it's not about always understanding what road you're going down or how to get down it.
Right, you only understand it, like, retroactively.
It's a challenge, you know?
Yeah.
I like a challenge.
Mm-hmm. As far as the... You know, I read before that you have particular themes for albums or ideas, and you kind of push in a particular direction. Do you always know when you're writing music for Skinny Puppy, or... I mean, do you know when you play a particular thing or you come up with a particular sound or whatever? Do you know that, okay, this is more Download and this is more Skinny Puppy...
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Usually, like, well, what was really odd is that I hadn't been working on Download for quite 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was writing this time, I was coming up with ideas that I wasn't really, like, questioning. I was just, like, writing and writing. I think I gave Mark 25 ideas of demos that were all different stuff, a bunch of stuff that, you know, was off the map as far as what could be deemed Skinny Puppy.
Right.
And that's how we end up with, like, songs that, like, you know, songs that maybe I'll do with Otto or something like that that will be a little bit different than what would be typically expected of Skinny Puppy.
Right.
And then it's sort of interesting because I can throw it at Mark and then see how he sees it and then see if it even works within the framework of something. So it's a bit like a question mark that needs answering, but then you don't know if it'll get answered.
Yeah. Does it feel like, because to a certain extent I feel like the last couple Skinny Puppy albums feel a lot more like, I mean, and obviously they should, because they feel more like, you know, they feel like, not necessarily Download, but they feel like a Kevin Key and Ogre solo thing kind of put together with some Skinny Puppy stuff in there. Is that just a matter of, you know, obviously not having Dwayne in the band to kind of have that third perspective and that other place to bounce ideas off of? Or is it just kind of the process in between, you know, the process album and, you know, all that time off for you guys to kind of grow?
I mean, equipment has changed, everything's changed, ideals have changed, everything is, you know, quite a bit different than when we made our last real Skinny Puppy album, which is now like 13, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know what went down, and how to make a Skinny Puppy album, but, you know, the ingredients are not essentially the same.
Right.
But the thing is that a thing I found with Skinny Puppy from day one is that nothing is ever predictable. Mm-hmm. Nothing. We can never predict what our albums will sound like because we don't really strive to be part of the scene.
Right.
We don't really strive to be, like, part of the gothic scene or part of the industrial scene or anything.
Right.
We've always just made music from day one as being something that we knew that was not... Well, the concept from day one was sort of anti-music. It was a bit like... I'd been through so much commercial-minded making music with images in vogue, the last thing I wanted to do was go down that same path.
Right.
So it was really about exploring what we liked and what we felt, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Purely and simple. So, essentially, we're still following that same path now, solo stuff and pattern art.
Do you feel... I also read that, you know, you were... You've always felt like the process was about the
No, that album's done. I mean, it's what we went through on that album is with particular phases of your career.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, what happened was that we wrote techno for the time period. And, you know, it's mostly a battle between ourselves and Ogre.
Mm-hmm.
Ogre wanted to go like a more of a ministry-esque sort of guitar sort of style. We wanted to go, we were starting to go more into like where I don't know, maybe you can look at Eyes of Stanley Payton or Furnace from Download and then see where we were sort of headed, because a lot of those songs on those two albums were actually destined to be Skinny Puppy songs. So we were maybe taking a side angle at that point, and a lot of the strife came from not really understanding where to go with it.
Uh-huh.
And then we were also, you know, facing a record label at the time that was saying, you know, we really don't think it's not allowing you to succeed because it keeps on holding you back. So after a few years of working on that album and realizing how miserable it was to just sort of to try and come up with new ways to do it, it was apparent to us that we needed to tell the record company that they made a big mistake by messing with our formulas.
Yeah.
So actually they went back to Rave and said, you know, we're sorry, the guys actually do believe that they're a big part of it to make a good album.
Mm-hmm.
Where we were, you know, halfway through the finish, you're going to shoot yourselves, and basically that's what we did.
Wow.
And then Dwayne died, and we were like still not finished, and we said, you know, fuck, if there's anything we're going to do, we're going to finish this album for the respect to Dwayne and for the respect to what we've been spending our time on.
Right.
And so it was a hard album, but at the same time it was mostly the people. It wasn't the fact of what we could or couldn't do in the music, because actually there's a few songs on that album that some of them are some of my favorite Skinny Puppy songs.
Yeah.
Like Crucible or, you know, Candle or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it at all. But I really had a problem with the period, with the time period, with everybody.
Mm.
And then we went back to Vancouver and started our own, you know, studio, record label, band, new bands, everything like that, and really sort of found ourselves in a new place where we, you know, we felt that we could go. And then with the death of Dwayne and everything, it just sort of like, it painted this broad ugliness onto everything. And I just sort of had to get away from Vancouver, and I moved to L.A.
Yeah.
And was running into Ogre when I would go to concerts. And though I hadn't spoken to him in a long time, we were sort of being quite friendly to each other. And they were running that show Doomsday. Made us just a ridiculous offer to reform and do a show, which we had never even considered.
Yeah.
So when we did that, it sort of put a lot of perspective on what we had done and so on. And when we made the show, it was really about coming back together and really understanding a lot of things that were special and stuff. And making the first album was, you know, the first new album, Great and Wrong, was pretty strange as well, because it was strange to find ourselves in the same room with each other, looking at each other and making a record again. It was almost like a shock.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the personality was sort of a bit subdued on the first record because we were too much in shock about actually making a record.
Yeah.
And then this album now is like sort of more or less comes back into you know, we've done some touring again with, like, I don't know, 68 or 70 shows around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we've sort of almost got to our comfort zone and then now past it again. We're almost like, we're almost a bit like the way we were before, where we don't hang out. We just, you know, we do our thing and we do it. That's our thing. You know, we're not looking to become this new this new entity. It's almost as though we're falling back into our old entity.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe some people are catching that style or sound or feel in the new album.
Mm-hmm. I definitely feel like, you know, the way that you were describing Emerson, Lake, and Palmer in that concert, when I was younger and I was kind of listening to just whatever was popular and on the radio or whatever, I read a review about Vivisect 6 and bought it because somebody compared it to reading a Clive Barker novel or something. And it was one of those things that I got, and, you know, those albums that you listen to and you're not ready for it. You
yeah.
know it's something that's amazing, but you don't know, your brain doesn't know how to handle it yet.
Yeah.
So I had to put it up on a shelf for a while, and then when I finally took it down, and just, it was kind of that awakening thing. And I just, it's great to see that you guys are making music again, and this new album, since I got it, hasn't left the player at all.
Cool.
So, I guess to kind of wrap up a little bit, at this point today, like, looking back and looking forward, I mean, obviously, you know, it probably didn't seem like Skinny Puppy was going to exist again, but... What's that?
Definitely not.
Yeah. But what do you feel, like, what songs and what... Are you satisfied with sort of Skinny Puppy's place in history, and where do you want to go with it?
I don't go back and, like, listen to the Images in Vogue records and think, like, wow, that was a great song.
Right.
But then, you know, I can go back and listen to stuff we made in 85 with Skinny Puppy and go, how the fuck did we make that sound?
Yeah.
And that's what really I like about it.
Mm.
Plus, I knew, you know, when we were doing it, that what was really the fun part is that I knew that we weren't trying to be anything but ourselves.
Right.
And I know that, you know, there's a lot of styles and a lot of bands and stuff like that that totally emulate another band or emulate a style or a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And though I wouldn't want to say that's, you know, that's a bad thing to do, it's just, it wasn't what we were doing.
Right.
And so there was a lot of, like, when we would hear a part go down or hear a new thing happen or hear a vocal or hear something, there was a lot of, like, mutual excitement in the studio that, like, was genuinely felt from everyone. So it's part of what's kept it going.
Yeah, I definitely don't feel like Skinny Puppy is the type of band that anyone has ever said, oh, wow, they're totally ripping off this person or taking this from this person. But I don't think the same thing can be said for a lot of other bands that are kind of in the genre. You know, I think a lot of other people have kind of taken things from Skinny Puppy and, you know, maybe distilled them down and made them a little bit more accessible to the masses or whatever. But I don't think that there's anything that matches kind of that creativity.
I mean, practically the whole goth industrial scene is based upon bands that have been inspired by, I guess, older bands that are really sort of following down the same path.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Just a couple of last quick little questions. I was listening to the new album today and the song Dow, the second song.
Mm-hmm.
That sample on there, is that from that Invasion of the Body Snatchers movie remake from a few years ago? The thing where she says, where are you going to run, where are you going to hide, because there's nobody like you left or something.
You know, a guy, a friend of mine, Dre Robinson,
mm-hmm.
Actually collaborated with me on that track, and that is, he was playing those whacked voices,
uh-huh.
And I believe you're right, but I don't know 100% for sure, but I believe you might be right.
Yeah.
We were hoping that they were a little more obscure.
Yeah. Well, I know
it wouldn't be so readily fast to recognize, but congratulations. I think maybe you did.
Well, I think I was the only person that watched that movie, probably besides him. But so you guys are planning a big tour in March?
Yeah.
And can we expect the same type of grand spectacle as usual?
You know, what would Skinny Puppy be without it?
Yeah. Do you have much input into that, or is that more of Ogre's kind of realm?
Once again, we've all had a concept about our live shows, but for me, you know, I had to handle, like, how am I going to play this live? How are we going to do this live?
Right.
And so my department is always about how the electronic music is going to get performed and so on. And I'm glad that's my job, because the rest of the job does come down to Ogre.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, like, the one that, you know, develops, like, what he wants to say or how he wants to say it, how it goes down. And then,
right. Very cool.
But, you know, typically it's a group effort again once we get going.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Everybody handles their own areas.
Yeah. Well, I know I've kept you a couple minutes longer than I was supposed to, so one last question that we always ask everyone, and it has nothing to do with anything that we've talked about, but it's an argument that we've had here at the magazine, and I figure, being in the band Skinny Puppy, you should have the answer to this. And the question is, in your professional opinion, do dogs have lips?
Do dogs have lips?
Yeah.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Otherwise, the spit would come flying out more.
That's what I always thought too. But it's become an argument. But
no, they do. Because some dogs' lips hang down, like bulldogs and stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Totally.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for your time, Kevin.
All right. Thank you.